Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Consider the prospects of a baby deprived of oxygen at birth, infected with a blinding and deafening form of tuberculosis soon after, later to suffer disfiguring skin infections, Tourette syndrome, depression, and some spectacular professional and financial failures. It would be easy to imagine a bleak outlook for such a child today, let alone one born in the cruel early 18th century. Samuel Johnson, though, managed to create some of the most influential literary works in English history, most famously the Dictionary of the English Language. So how did Johnson achieve such extraordinary success despite his setbacks? And could all that suffering in some ways have contributed to that success? Jeffrey Myers explores Johnson's extraordinary life and works in his newest book called Samuel Johnson, The Struggle. Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Good morning. Thank you.
You have, I know, written dozens of books translated into a dozen languages, but I have to wonder if even for you, Johnson felt like an especially fascinating source of material.
Well, I think yes. I did graduate work on Johnson way back in my youth, and it's been a lifelong interest. The first dissertation I wrote was on Johnson, and the first articles I wrote was about him. So he's had this hold on my imagination ever since I became an adult, I suppose.
And this guy was really a mess, not just physically, but emotionally.
Both. Physical and emotional, yes. He was born with radical defects, blind in one eye, deaf in one ear, scrofula, which was tuberculosis of the lymph nodes. And as his life progressed, his health just got worse and worse. It seems that he had Tourette syndrome, which is a kind of involuntary spasmodic motion, which affected him when he was sitting and also affected his walk. But I think worst of all was the psychological problems. He said he inherited from his father a vile melancholy, which meant that he was depressed for a great deal of his life and even feeling suicidal sometimes, though he never actually thought that he would kill himself because of his religious beliefs. But he had to fight against it, and one of the ways he did fight against melancholy, or what we call depression, is to have a circle of friends. He said a man must keep his friendship in good repair, or he'll find out that he has no friends when he gets old. And his friends included some of the most brilliant people of his time, and possibly the most brilliant circle of people in the whole of English literature. I'm specifically thinking of the writer Oliver Goldsmith, the painter Joshua Reynolds, the politician Edmund Burke, Boswell, who became Johnson's biographer, and many, many other eminent people who met regularly, but also met privately and socially in country houses and in city dinners. And David Garrick was another one who had been Johnson's pupil when they both left Litchfield in the Midlands when Johnson was a young man, and Garrick was still in his teens, and these obscure people became really the famous writer of his time and the most famous actor in Europe in the 18th century. So he needed, and he was very reluctant ever to go to sleep, because in sleep it was a kind of little death or nightmares or dreams or disturbing thoughts or guilt feelings or religious inadequacies or fear of damnation or threat of death or more diseases or problems with his wife, who was much older and who was sick, though he was devoted to her and he loved her. And he had, in his weird way, I suppose, something of a good marriage. He said when he was a young man, who else but Teddy, as he called her, Elizabeth, who else would have married a man like me? He was very unprepossessing as a young man, huge, strong, ugly, awkward, ungainly, with a kind of Frankenstein monster sort of walk, a kind of shuffling. And yet, despite all this, he was also athletic, surprisingly. Not athletic in ball games, because he couldn't see the ball, but athletic in things like swimming, running, jumping.
Yeah, and you say one of the things he did to combat his depression was he would walk 32 miles one way and then 32 miles back for the exercise benefits, I guess.
Yes, walking was another way to fight depression, and I think that walk was to see a friend in Birmingham from Litchfield. I mean, it's a hell of a walk. If you walk 3 or 4 miles an hour, that's 8 hours or 9 hours each way. But he had this strength, and even today I think people do. Don't they take walks to soothe depression, to kind of calm themselves down, get some quiet, and look at nature and be by themselves or maybe with their dog or with a friend? It does have a kind of calming effect. And I think all kinds of non-competitive sports at a reasonable level are sort of psychotherapeutic. It allows you to release energy, and it takes your mind off your problems for that hour or two that you're playing. So I think tennis, which I do 3 times a week, is the cheapest psychotherapy going.
So his father was not wealthy, but he did sell books for a living. What sort of influence did he have on what young Samuel read and what his education was?
Well, imagine if you had as your personal library, when there weren't many libraries in existence, there was one in the cathedral at Litchfield. Litchfield was a cathedral town, which meant it had a bishop. But Johnson had a whole bookstore to read in, and he could be directed by his father or by his teachers to read this or that book. But mostly he would just kind of range through the books, reading. He said no man ever read a book through. In other words, no man with any sense sat down and read the first word and all the other words till the last word. You didn't need to do that. You could just tear the heart out of the book, as he said, and find the essence of it and also what you needed, which is not necessarily what the author provided. So one time, for example, he was looking for an apple, which I think his parents or his younger brother had hid behind a book, and he discovered Petrarch, the early Italian, early Renaissance Italian poet, and he had heard about Petrarch somewhere or other, so he just sat down and read through the book on Petrarch. So it was that kind of intellectual discovery, which I think is better than what you learn in the classroom, because you're stimulated to seek out knowledge and to acquire the knowledge that you need. And his father was a bookish and a learned man, and he had a reasonable business in town, and he'd go to market towns and have stalls, and then he'd also get on his horse with saddlebags full of books and ride around even as far as Ireland and the north of England, selling books. And he was very welcome too, because people wanted books, educated people out in the country who were away from booksellers in London. And also Michael Johnson, Samuel's father, could talk about books. He didn't only sell them, he knew them, he knew what was inside them. And a lot of the books were theological books or ecclesiastical history, the sort of books that very few people read today outside of the profession. But one of those books, William Law's A Serious Call, which is pretty rough going today. I myself have not read it from cover to cover, but read into it.
No man ever does.
That's right. Had this effect on Johnson when he was, I think it was his year in Oxford, where he had always kind of been indifferent to religion and even a bit of a scoffer. And suddenly he read this Serious Call, which turned him toward religion seriously for the rest of his life. Which leads to another real problem with Johnson. Most of the time when people have religious belief and believe in God, they believe in a benevolent God, and they believe in a religion that brings comfort to you and the hope after life of salvation. With Johnson, it was just the opposite. And he would have been better off psychologically and been less depressed if he wasn't religious, because religion to him was the fear of damnation. The sense that he was an evil, corrupt, and guilty man, that he had not done his duty before God in life, and that he was going to be damned. And somebody said to him, well, what do you mean by damned? And he said, sent to hell and burned everlastingly. It was very vivid to him. And that's why he had this terrible, terrible fear of death, because he didn't think that he would be saved. He thought that he would be damned. And by almost anybody's standards, Johnson was an exemplarily good man, kind, charitable, generous, helpful, decent. I think his only real fault as a human being was he could be rather cruel in his words. You know, if somebody annoyed him or offended him or irritated him, he gave very, very sharp and wounding and cruel retorts, which really sort of devastated people. In some ways, I just thought of this minute. Wittgenstein, the 20th century Austrian philosopher, also had that ability to crush people with his words and his superior intellect, and even discourage people who had promising careers. He said, you know, you have no future in philosophy. Why don't you just work in a factory? And people would give it up because Wittgenstein said so. So every once in a while, some poor clergyman or some timid fellow or somebody who opened his mouth at the wrong time. Johnson once said to a dense fellow, he said to Johnson, I don't understand you. And Johnson said, Sir, I have found you an argument, but I am not obliged to find you an understanding. So the man was crushed. The people in the room laughed, glad that they had escaped Johnson's artillery. And then afterwards, Johnson felt bad, and very often he apologized for his outburst. And his friend, Mrs. Thrale, said, you know, you really can be very sharp-tongued. And he said, no, really, I'm kind, but people provoke me rather easily. So while denying the fact that he was cruel in his words, he also kind of admitted that he was easily provoked.
It would seem to explain why he was a failed schoolmaster.
Sorry, I have to speak just a little louder.
Sure. That sort of cruelty would explain why he was unsuccessful. He tried to start a school when he was a young man.
Oh, well, he really wasn't cut out for schoolmastering, though he spent literally years trying to find a job as a schoolmaster. The trouble was, I mean, he certainly had the intellectual capacity. There's no doubt about that. He was a zillion years over the head of pupils or other teachers or the headmaster. What he lacked, first of all, and it seems odd to be a schoolmaster, that you would need a degree from Oxford or Cambridge just to teach little boys in school. And he didn't have that because he left Oxford after 1 year for financial or psychological reasons or intellectual reasons. He was dissatisfied with Oxford. But later, he was terribly attached to the university and went back there about 20 times. So very often, he lost out to somebody else who had an Oxford or Cambridge degree. At one point, he tried, through friends, to get Swift, who was Dean of St. Patrick's and influential in Dublin, to get him an honorary master's degree from Dublin, and that didn't work. We don't know exactly what happened, but Johnson blamed Swift for not helping him, though Swift didn't know Johnson from Adam, and there was no reason to give this unknown person an honorary degree. The other problem was his physical twitchings and jerkings of his limbs and mutterings and clicking with his tongue and shaking with his head. After I finished the book, it occurred to me one thing I would have put in if I had thought of it earlier. If he was shaking his head all the time, how could he read the lines in the book, especially with defective vision in one eye? You know, I imagine holding a book out and then shaking your head while you're trying to read it, the lines jerking up and down. And very often he read by candlelight at night. You know, half the time he was reading at night and, you know, without electricity, obviously, just by candlelight. No wonder his vision was difficult. No wonder he really couldn't read the whole book but tore what he needed. So finally, after all these unsuccessful interviews where he would walk miles to the school, and I think he must have failed about six times to get a job. And finally, when he married Teddy, who was a widow, 20 years older, with some inheritance, I forget, either from her husband or from her own family. He started this school right outside of Litchfield, and he was probably the most unsuccessful schoolmaster in educational history. He got this huge building and grounds and had to furnish it at least with some desks and minimal furniture, and he never managed to acquire more than three pupils, Davy Garrick, great actor, Garrick's brother, Peter, and one other boy, and that was it. And so after, I guess it was 6 or 9 months or so, one school year, the school closed, and Johnson, leaving Teddy behind so he could get established in London until they could sell that schoolhouse, because it was more than just a school. I mean, it was a house with lots of rooms in it.
Let me stop you there, Jeffrey. We need to take a quick break. Jeffrey Myers is my guest. His new book is called Samuel Johnson, The Struggle. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author Jeffrey Myers is my guest. His new book is called Samuel Johnson, The Struggle. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. So he uses his wife's money, loses his wife's money on this school, and so they need a way to support themselves. He knows he can write, but publishing was really changing in the 18th century. You no longer have these wealthy patrons paying people to create works. So can you talk about the climate in which Samuel Johnson became a writer?
He didn't really go for patronage, though, as you say, that was the current way of publishing. But he got into what we would call the new journalism. They just were starting. He was born the year of the Tatler, which was a periodical that came out a couple of times a week with short essays in it by Steele and Addison. And when Johnson went to London, he first made contact with the Gentleman's Magazine, which was a kind of compendium of news and gossip and shipping and personalities and translations from foreign authors and poetry and everything you can think of, just sort of thrown in. And this was this mishmash in a way, but a rather high level for that time, was a new thing. And Johnson started writing at first anonymously, and even most of the things that he published in his lifetime were published anonymously, which was sort of common, and yet it wasn't really the way to make your name, and yet you made your name in an underground way by people knowing in London that Samuel Johnson was the author of this or that. And Johnson was a very impressive person. Physically, he was huge and strong and very courageous. There's stories of him holding three robbers at bay in the street till the watch came, or tearing two dogs apart from each other who were fighting in a house, and threatening one time in a theater, somebody took his seat on the stage. People sat on the stage sometimes, and Johnson needed to do that for his hearing and vision. And when a man refused to surrender the seat that Johnson had reserved, he just picked the man in the chair up and threw him into the pit. I don't know what happened to the people in the pit on which the chair and the man landed. They may have fared worse than the man who was thrown. Anyway, he was not the sort of person to mess with. And when a book dealer told him he had hired Johnson to do a catalog and said Johnson wasn't working fast enough, he whacked the man with a folio, this huge, you know, super dictionary-sized volume of work, and knocked the man down. And later they said, "Did you really do that?" He said, "He was insolent, and I beat him." So you can't be insolent with Johnson. So the first thing was his physical impressiveness, combined, of course, with his physical weirdness. The second thing was his intellect was tremendous. And there's a story of somebody seeing him in the back of a bookseller and thinking, I think it was Samuel Richardson, thinking that he was sort of the village idiot. I mean, you know, he was drooling and blabbering and, you know, twitching and making all these faces. And then he was introduced, and he came out and started talking in this most brilliant way. So people wanted to hire him, and he started off not only writing for the Gentleman's Magazine, but also doing what was called parliamentary reporting. In those days, you were not allowed to keep a record of what went on in Parliament. They wanted to be free from any kind of public constraints so they could do their political deals and their corrupt little arrangements without interference. So magazine editors would sort of smuggle people into Parliament to take shorthand notes. Of course, they couldn't really keep up with the speeches, but they sort of gave the gist of what was going on in each speech, and then they'd bring it back to the Gentleman's Magazine office. And Johnson, for a couple of years, then more or less made up the speeches on the subjects that were reported. For example, you know, something to do with the Navy or taxation or foreign wars or treatment of prisoners or penal reform or the whatever it was that they were talking about in Parliament, every conceivable issue. And one time, many years later, he was at dinner and somebody said, you know, I think that speech by Lord so-and-so is one of the most brilliant speeches ever given since the time of Demosthenes in ancient Greece. And Johnson said, I wrote that speech myself. In a garret on so-and-so street in London. And he didn't say it as a bragging. He just said it as a matter of fact. I wrote that speech. And some of the people who gave the speeches admitted that Johnson's version of their speech was much better than the speech that they actually gave at the time. So that was another kind of writing. And then he started writing poetry. And he did write two terrific and still very, very readable poems. London, and The Vanity of Human Wishes, both satires and both based on the Roman satirist Juvenal. In other words, they were called imitations, not translations from the Latin, but taking the Latin themes and modernizing them to meet the needs of current issues in London. And then toward the end of his life, on a very old friend of his who had been living in his household for many years, Dr. Levitt, who wasn't exactly a doctor, but he was a practitioner of medicine among the poor, who often was paid in drink, which was the kind of currency he liked the best. And when Levitt died, Johnson was very moved and touched by it. Johnson, for all his toughness, by the way, was very sentimental and also easily moved to tears and not even embarrassed to cry in public when something really affected him deeply, which it often did. He had this tremendous feeling. For example, when he was reading Hamlet as a boy and the ghost appeared in the play, he rushed out into the street to make sure that everything was still real and there were real people out there, because to him the ghost was real. And he said he couldn't read King Lear because Cordelia dying at the end was just so painful and so agonizing to him that he just simply tore his guts up, and it was just too much for him to read The Death of Cordelia. And in fact, in the 18th century, that was considered a lapse on Shakespeare's part. So various popular playwrights rewrote King Lear, where Cordelia survived and married happily at the end, and it wasn't really a tragedy, but something that had a positive ending.
Johnson obviously famously sort of populated his dictionary with quote after quote after quote from William Shakespeare. Can you talk about why you think Shakespeare resonated so deeply and so personally with Johnson?
Well, he did the dictionary, and then he did an edition of Shakespeare. So the dictionary was kind of on the way to the edition of Shakespeare, which is still important because Johnson's interpretation of various passages in Shakespeare's plays were so brilliant and perceptive and incisive that they still are current today. And if you read editions of Shakespeare, which I read lots of them, you can see Johnson's ideas being cited or quoted or alluded to still. And any dictionary of quotations, even today, the standard one being Bartlett's, still quotes Shakespeare and the Bible more than any other source, because Shakespeare just is, you know, tremendously quotable and seems to have had, to a kind of almost unbelievable way, this insight into human nature and ability to express it in words. And many times when we use expressions, we don't even realize that they come from Shakespeare. They've just come into the language so in such a common and ordinary way. And if you see Shakespeare's plays, which are still done, you know, all over the place all the time, I saw a couple of in the Shakespeare Festival at Ashland, Oregon last summer. They play very well. They're really still terrific. So the whole way Johnson did the dictionary was really quite extraordinary. There never had been a dictionary of English language before Johnson. And he wasn't trying to say, this is the way the language has to be. He was trying to say, this is the way the language is. And he understood that the language is always changing. He didn't really try to nail it down. But the main thing he did that was so interesting, apart from all the different definitions of a single word, sometimes as many as 30 or 40, is using quotations from earlier books from the last, roughly speaking, 200 years before 1755 to illustrate the first use or an early use of a certain word. So you not only have a definition of a word, but you'd have a usage of the word in a famous writer like Shakespeare, or it could be, you know, anybody in the Renaissance or late 17th century, early 18th century. Or sometimes even he quoted contemporaries rarely, and every once in a while he'd throw in something by himself without attributing it to Johnson, but just calling it anonymous. So the range is tremendous. What he'd do is get this tremendous number of books, and he'd read, and every time he came across a passage that he wanted to use in the dictionary, he'd mark it, and then one of his assistants, or amanuenses, and he had six of them off and on for about 10 years, mostly Scotsmen, desperately poor. A couple of them died along the way, and Johnson paid for the funeral. And they were all up there in the top room of his house, in Gough Square, which is still Dr. Johnson's house in London. You can go see it. A really nice 18th century house. And they would copy these things on slips, and then they'd put the slips in order, or they'd lose the slips, or they'd misplace them, or they'd copy them wrong, or they'd get them out of order. It was really the most tremendous effort. And after 10 years, he managed to do it, and the definitions in the dictionary are really very good and very readable. In fact, what I've been trying to do, I must say unsuccessfully, is to get a tear-off calendar, which would have a quote from Johnson for every day of the year, from his dictionary. Some of them are clear, some of them are opaque, like his definition of network, which I can't quote, but it's extremely complicated. Some of them are politically biased, like oats, if I can remember oats being used to feed horses in England and people in Scotland, that sort of thing. He was anti-Scots, he was anti-Whig, he was anti-anybody, he was anti-the Church of England. He was biased against Catholics because he was a staunch Anglican, and that's part of the fun. I mean, you don't read it for objectivity, you read it for the Johnson's intellect and for the state of the language in the mid-18th century and for the way it influenced dictionaries that came afterwards, and it did influence dictionaries very strongly. Noah Webster, for example, relied very heavily on when he did the American Dictionary. And Johnson was also very strongly influenced on the founding fathers of America, and people like Washington and Adams and any one of those well-read early American political leaders knew Johnson's works and knew the dictionary and used his diction and his phrasing in their speeches, which were much better than the speeches we get today as far as the grace of the language and elegance of expression and that sort of thing, right from Washington through Lincoln.
How did he befriend Hester and Henry Thrale?
Sorry, say that again?
How did he befriend the Thrales?
The Thrales, ah, yes. Well, he was introduced to the Thrales by Arthur Murphy, who was a minor playwright, and they just hit it off, although they were very different. Mr. Thrale was a brewer, wealthy. His brewery still exists under a different name, under the name of Courage, which you can still buy in England today. And he was a bit of a Philistine, though he had taken the grand tour. In other words, when he finished university, he toured around Europe for about a year, which many well-off people did. And then he came back and he was succeeded his father as Member of Parliament for Southwark, which is just south of the river where the Bishop of London's residence is. And the brewery is still there in some form. And he was a Philistine. And then his wife was this tiny Welsh woman, very perky, very lively, very bright, very curious, very social. And she and her husband didn't really get on. You know, it had been a kind of arranged marriage. And he was a bit of a brute. He was a philanderer, and he did not really take her feelings much into consideration, rather selfish. But he entertained lavishly, and he invited all of Johnson's friends, and he had portraits by Reynolds commissioned of all these different people in the circle of Garrick and Goldsmith and Burke and so on. And Johnson eventually, when Mrs. Thrale came to his house and saw how horribly he was living with all the dependents and these really dreary, miserable people that Johnson took in and just allowed to live in his house more or less for the rest of his life, people who were, well, there was an ex-prostitute, and there was a blind woman, and there was a drunkard, Dr. Levitt, and there was his black servant, Frank Barber, who had been a slave, who Johnson had inherited and freed and educated, and Frank eventually became a Methodist preacher and had children that he named, two children named Sam. The first one died, and then the second one survived. And Mrs. Thrale was horrified by the way Johnson lived in squalor. I mean, his clothes were filthy and so on. But he always said, you know, he knew how to sew on a button and mend a stocking and that sort of thing. She said, why don't you come and live in our house Monday through Thursday, whatever it was, and then go home on weekends. And that's more or less what he did. He lived with the Thrales, and he was, you know, like their star attraction, the most famous writer of the age. You know, everybody wanted to come and meet him, and the Thrales loved to entertain, including Henry Thrale's mistress, Sophie Stretfield, this very pretty young girl, who empty-headed but rather cute and made Hester Thrale's life a torment because Henry showed his affection toward his mistress so openly. And Johnson took Henry's part, though he was sympathetic to Hester. He sort of felt that Henry was the boss and he had to support him. So he didn't ever criticize Henry. Oh, Henry was allowed to criticize Johnson when Johnson talked too much or ate too much or drank too much. Mr. Thrale, in his country house, which was in Clapham, which is now just a couple of tube stops from the north side of the Thames, in those days was out in the country. I guess it's somewhere like 12 miles or so from central London. So Johnson lived very comfortably there, which leads really to the most contentious part of his life, and that is this question of manacles and chains
and a sadomasochistic relationship with Hester Thrale.
That's right. We're approaching the break. I wonder if we should wait till the, or shall I start this? Or will telephone calls be coming in, do you suppose?
We'll have some callers on the line perhaps after the break. We've got about 30 seconds before we take another break, so maybe you can sort of summarize, and then we'll get into some tasteful detail, if that's possible,
this big question of what happened with Johnson and Mrs. Thrale, and did they have a sadomasochistic relationship? And I argue in my book, after examining and presenting the evidence very carefully, that in fact... He was chained up and whipped by her, not very hard, but more like symbolically. And that is a big issue in Johnson's studies, which we shall return to after the break.
Thank you for setting us up. My guest is Jeffrey Myers. His new book is called Samuel Johnson, The Struggle. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. And if you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are talking this hour about a new biography of Samuel Johnson called Samuel Johnson, The Struggle. Author Jeffrey Myers is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. So throughout his life, Johnson has this extraordinary appetite for sex and coupled with this extraordinary guilt about it, which it appears to have manifested itself, as you found in your research, in an interest in sadomasochism.
It would seem so. There's no doubt that the manacles and chains existed. They were part of the inventory of Mrs. Thrale's possessions, which were sold after her death. And they were originally purchased. Imagine going to a store and saying, I need some whips and chains and manacles. Because Johnson felt that his vile melancholy and depression would actually descend into actual madness, and that he would have to be forcibly constrained so that he wouldn't hurt himself and other people. That was the original purpose of it.
Yeah, he asked to be locked away in the event that he should completely lose his senses.
Yeah, there was this room upstairs, you know, where he would be closed in just in case. That never happened, by the way. I mean, he didn't really ever lose his reason, and this never had to be done. So the question is then what was done with these whips and chains? And I want to make two points. One is, I think that Johnson indulging in this practice, which was mild, makes the struggle, which is the major theme of my book, from birth to death, all the more moving and poignant and tragic, that he felt the need to punish himself in this way that was just as much symbolic as actual. The reason this is a big issue in Johnson's life is that a lot of Johnson scholars have refused to accept this evidence. They just say that this is inconsistent with my noble and exalted and idealistic view of Johnson, and therefore it could never have happened, even though letters exist back and forth between Mrs. Thrale and Dr. Johnson talking about this very subject, some of them written in French, so the servants who delivered them or might see them in the room would not be able to read them. It seems to me the evidence is incontrovertible, and I don't see how it can be denied, and I think that it enhances the depth and meaning of Johnson's life and does not degrade him in any way. It just shows that was yet another thing that he had to struggle against, the struggle against the fear of madness and the struggle against sexual desires. He was a chaste and celibate man despite tremendous urges. And after Teddy died, when he was around 45 or so, he lived for another 30 years, and there's no evidence that he ever had sex with anyone, certainly not with Mrs. Thrale. He may well have consorted with prostitutes before his marriage to Teddy when he was in his early 20s and he was hanging around low-life London with friends like Richard Savage, who really were given to sexual and physical indulgence. And I think Johnson felt very guilty about that. So that's a part of his life that I argue for, and others have argued against it, and that really seems to be a big issue. And I talk about it in the preface and list all the people who denied it and then present the evidence and argue for it, not in any sensational way at all, but to simply add meaning and interest and understanding to a part of his life that I felt was very important and couldn't simply be swept under the carpet.
Was he in love with Mrs. Thrale?
Well, there was some talk of him marrying Mrs. Thrale after Henry died. He died of almost some kind of stroke after overeating. A tremendous eater and drinker, and just an example of somebody who literally ate himself to death. He was warned by doctors to restrain himself, but he just couldn't do it. And Boswell, in one of his crazier moments, wrote this kind of obscene poem anonymously where he talked about the sexual dalliance of Johnson and Thrale. But Johnson may possibly have wanted to marry Mrs. Thrale. He was in love with her in some way, but it was also a father-daughter relationship and a kind of fond friendship. I think he would have loved to marry Mrs. Thrale to have some bright, pretty young thing look after him in old age. But she had other ideas, and she became very interested while her husband was alive, innocently, in her children's music teacher, an Italian singer and musician called Gabriele Piozzi. And eventually, after a long and unhappy marriage, she didn't really have Johnson in mind as her next husband, but this young, handsome, jolly, adoring Italian. And she defied society and defied her family and defied her children and defied Johnson and said, I am going for love. And it was simply outrageous to marry, one, somebody who had no money, two, somebody who was a foreigner, and three, somebody who was Catholic. So, but she did, and they went off to Italy and more or less lived happily ever after. She had a great marriage to Piozzi, and eventually toward the end of her life the children were reconciled, and I can't remember who died first, Piozzi or Hester, but anyway, it was a good marriage. And Johnson, and this was maybe the worst and one of the few bad things he ever did in his life, so I don't like to sit around judging him. A biographer is not a moral judge. But he did write a very, very cruel letter to Hester when she, after hiding her love for Piozzi, announced at the last second that she was just about to marry him and to leave England with him to go live in Italy. And Johnson wrote a really devastating letter. And to give Hester her due, she wrote back a very sharp retort to Johnson, of the sort that few people ever tried, defending her own actions and defending Piozzi as a really fine man and top of his profession as a musician and somebody who would make a good husband and somebody she was in love with and wanted to marry and wanted to live with and wanted to live with in Italy. One of Johnson's wishes was always to go to Italy, and they were going to go. He was going to go with the Thrales, And just simply days before they were about to set out, Thrale's oldest son and heir died suddenly when he was 12 or something like that. And, of course, the trip to Italy was postponed, and then it never came off. So the trip to Italy was made by Hester and Piazzi, but not by Johnson. That may have been a secondary thing. So when she wrote back to him and said, defending Piazzi and defending herself, Johnson backed off, very rare for him. And he more or less said, well, if that's the way you feel, good luck to you, and you have my blessing, and, you know, in some ways I understand what you want to do. So that was it was really the most important relationship with a woman, maybe with any other person in his whole life, I would say. Hester Thrale, she left these two huge volumes of her diaries with this tremendous amount of interesting material about Johnson, way beyond simply the chains and whips. And she wrote anecdotes of Johnson, beat Boswell to the punch. Boswell and Mrs. Thrale were rivals. Of course, Boswell's book is greater, but Mrs. Thrale came out first, and Mrs. Thrale was used by Boswell when he absorbed some of her stuff in his life, because she was on the scene day-to-day with Johnson, and Boswell was mostly in Scotland and just came down to London, roughly speaking, for a month a year when the court was out of session in Edinburgh, to be with Johnson for, roughly speaking, a month a year for the last 20 or so years of Johnson's life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Jeffrey Myers is my guest. The new book is Samuel Johnson, The Struggle. Let's speak to Anita in Dallas. Hello, Anita.
Hi. I noted your reference to Edinburgh, and I wondered if possibly it was his experiences with events there that led to all those invidious comparisons that I believe he made in his dictionary?
Well, actually, it was the other way around. He made all those... He had negative feelings about Scotland. Part of it was a kind of standing joke with Boswell. And part of it was, you know, that the Scots were rebels against the English, and there was a Jacobite movement was trying to overthrow the Protestant kings of England and replace them with Catholic kings. But when he went to Scotland, he took a tour of the Hebrides with Boswell, which was one of Boswell's lifelong ambitions. And Boswell wrote a book about it, and Johnson wrote a book about it. Really interesting, the same tour written by the same two people, Johnson writing about the tour and Boswell writing about Johnson. So Boswell's book was really more interesting than Johnson's on this particular subject. What Boswell leaves out, and this is really a pity, we know from Boswell's journals, which were not published till the 20th century, that Boswell wanted to introduce Johnson to his father, who was an eminent judge. And Boswell didn't get along with his father, and the father was very severe, very critical, very judgmental, very Whig, and very Presbyterian, exactly the opposite of Johnson's personality and Johnson's political and religious beliefs. So in some ways, a clash was inevitable, and they really went at it. Boswell's father, being a top rank lawyer and judge and really knew how to defend his views, and Boswell was so embarrassed by the that he left it out of the tour to the Hebrides. And but I would say that going to Scotland actually modified and mollified Johnson's views and made him like Scotland more and reduce his prejudices, which he had felt before he ever visited the country. And I think this often happens. You feel negative about something because you've read it or taught it or been told it, and then when you go there and see for yourself, you find out that there's much more about Scotland that you admire than you had ever saw before. And what he really admired was the feudal chieftains and the clans, and he admired the hospitality of the people in some of these far-flung and very rough-hewn islands that they went to, where it was literally risking your life if a storm came up, as it did when they took a little boat, you know, from island to island.
Did he consider the dictionary to be his most important work?
I mean, that's hard to say. Important in what way? Probably his most influential, yes. But his edition of Shakespeare is very important. His Lives of the Poets, which I consider his greatest work, his last completed major work, tremendously influential. The edition of Shakespeare, The Lives of the Poets, The Dictionary, The Ramblers, and probably the most read of his works is Rasselas, which has been in print ever since 1759, whatever the date is, you know, for 250 years. and it was written, I think, the same year as Voltaire's Candide, and they're both kind of moral fables, and it's still very readable and even kind of funny. Johnson's humor, usually he's kind of a little heavy and serious and moralistic in his works, but the humor comes into Rasselas in a rather cute way, and it is, you know, the philosopher who tries out his wings and falls into the water. I mean, in some ways it's even slapstick sometimes, but Rasselas searching, you know, searching for happiness, searching for truth, searching for the meaning of life. He's young, he's naive, like Candide, and he's basically disillusioned time after time after time, and that really is the comic mode of the moral fable.
And what for you makes the lives of the poet the best, the lives of the poets the best work?
Well, Johnson said biography is, you know, the greatest literary form. And he himself wrote many biographies early on for those magazines that we talked about at the beginning of Renaissance scholars and doctors and people he admired, some of them Dutch, German, French. It's just that he captured the lives, the essence of the lives of the character. Usually the lives are divided in two parts. One was the life and character, and then the other was the works. And they vary enormously in length. Some of them are only a page or two long, based on writers who even professors these days never heard of. They're so obscure. They're only known because Johnson wrote about them at the time. And some of them are 100 or 125 pages long on major English poets like Pope and Milton and Dryden and Swift. And again, with Swift, for example, you get Johnson's prejudices coming into play, and he was very hostile to Swift, who he thought was irreverent toward religion, and also, though he was a dean, and also Johnson thought he hadn't helped him get this degree. But we're not even clear that Swift ever got the letter, or that maybe he tried and failed. So Johnson has influenced our way of looking at these writers, and you really can't study any of these writers thoroughly without knowing what Johnson said about them somewhere along the line. What he has to say, I think, is really terrific. Although I also talk about his method, which is very careless and very lackadaisical, and he wouldn't do research. Somebody offered to introduce him to a close friend of Pope, I think it was Lord Marchmont, and Johnson said he wasn't interested in meeting Lord Marchmont. And he said, well, you're writing this life of Pope, don't you want to meet his friend? And he said, well, if it rained, I'd hold out my hand, but I wouldn't walk across the street to meet him. So there's a kind of perversity. He said of Congreve's plays, I haven't read them in a long time. I mean, there's no question of sitting down and rereading the plays before you write about them. It was just he read Congreve's plays 20 years ago, and he remembered certain things about them, and so he kind of threw them down. He thought, what the hell? You know, I mean, at that point, he's an old man, and he's famous, and he really wasn't going to kill himself doing all this research. But he had the intellectual ability to write on all these different people for 200 years, past 200 years.
Jeffrey Myers' latest book is called Samuel Johnson, The Struggle. Jeffrey, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.